Ryan, are you?
Mike's going to give an intro to the Hancock portfolio. He's transitioning on to oversee that account, and then we'll turn over to Hancock to do a market review, and then we'll go into closed session to review the portfolio. Mike, you there?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Gotcha.
So I guess, like Ryan said, I'm taking over the Hancock. John, can you go to the next slide? Great. Just a quick reminder on who Hancock is. So Hancock is our agricultural investment. They've been with us since 1998. It consists of currently 7 almond and pistachio properties that are located in California and 1 apple property that's located in Washington. This has been one of the better performing private assets that we've held onto. Performance has been excellent since inception. Since inception, IRR is approximately 15%, with an investment multiple of 3.5x. So the plan for this is to hold it in DPFP's portfolio in the long term. They've been selling down the properties in the last 5 years to meet our target allocation. Currently, the agricultural allocation is sitting at 5% of the pension assets, and Hancock is sitting at a worth of $100 million right now. I'm going to turn it over to Stuart and his team at Hancock to go over in detail the investment.
What, can you just tell us, Mike, what page are we on diligent here for following the presentation?
Should be 124.
One what?
124.
Thank you.
All right, Stuart and team, are you guys online?
Yes. Hi, Stuart Patillo here. Thank you, Ryan and Mike, for coordinating our participation today. And for a good introduction, I always like to start an interview or a presentation with a strong past performance. So thank you for that, Mike. We're pleased to be able to give you a bit of a high-level update on not just the TMPC portfolio, but a bit of a global agricultural market update as well. First, I want to introduce myself. I'm new to the account. My name's Stuart Patillo. I joined H&RG last October from a Canadian-based farmland investment manager, and really excited to be a part of this, you know, old and successful relationship between DPFP and H&RG. Today with me, I also have, if we could move forward to slide 126, I have a Skeet Ponder, our portfolio analyst, who's been on the portfolio for quite some time. We also have Carl Evers, our Vice President, Water Resource Management, out of North America, based in California, who will give us an update on some of the water issues that the portfolio faces. And we also have Dan Cerna, our Associate Director and Senior Agricultural Economist, to give us a global ag market update. But I do want to point out and put an asterisk to Dan's title, as he is actually joining us on the portfolio management team, and we're really excited to have his expertise and knowledge in our active portfolio management. So if we move on to slide 127, I won't belabor a huge introduction to H&RG. We are a 30-year-old history in farmland investment with a global print footprint. If we move on to page 128, across North America, Australia, and South America. And between the timber investments and farmland investments, we have over $14 billion under management, with $4 billion of that being focused on the farmland strategy. And farmland's new expansion programs have been in the Canadian market as well, a growing footprint in South America as well. If we move on to slide 129, it gives a brief history of the sustainability and the stewardship that we approach our investments with. I won't go too deep into this, but I just want to make sure that, you know, as a lot of buzzwords kick around the investment world of ESG, impact investing, and sustainability, it's an approach inherent to H&RG's, you know, investment thesis, knowing that we're long-term investors, that we're stewards of the land, and in terms of taking care of those assets properly, will only reflect in higher value. And the TMPC portfolio is a prime example of that. So, you know, I will talk a little bit about how this has culminated into the leading harvest platform later in the presentation. But for now, I just want to give that theme of the fact that, you know, we all have always been and always will be approaching our investments from a sustainable perspective. If we move on to page 130, I want to give a brief update and history of the portfolio and where it sits today. So established in 1998 with an original allocation of $25 million and then three additional allocations after that for a total of $61 million. And they were all buried in different strategies and exposures. But in 2015, H&RG and DPFP came together with an understanding of reducing the overall exposure to farmland and reorienting the portfolio to a higher income focus. So over the past 5 years, H&RG has embarked on a disposition program which resulted in the sale of 16 properties and over $70 million in proceeds that were directly distributed back to DPFP. And now as it sits today in 2021, we have a West Coast of the U.S. focused portfolio focused solely on permanent crops and split between almonds, pistachios, and apples. And this portfolio is really well positioned to continue to cash flow high levels of distributions back to DPFP and to weather a lot of the different, you know, ups and downs of the agricultural industry and global market. And in order to give us a bit of a better understanding of where that sits, I'm going to hand it over to Dan Cerna on page 131 to give us a market update.
Thank you very much, Stuart. And it's good to be back with all of you again. When we last visited together a year ago, really a lot of uncertainty around COVID, and so it's nice to be able to come back with a resurging U.S. and global economy and things making their way back towards normal. So if we take a look at the next slide, I want to highlight a few of the trends that are affecting ag markets across the board. Then what I'll do is turn to the tree nuts and apples specifically with a few comments, but want to put them in context. You know, the first thing I guess I'd mention, not as specific to this portfolio, but has been, you know, resurging agricultural prices that have been noted in the press. And again, a lot of this has to do with the reopening of the economy and the recovery in China. And so a lot of that has been centered around grains and oil seeds. But I would note, too, that for pistachios, almonds, you know, China is a major destination. In fact, it's the number one U.S. export destination for pistachios, and it is number two for almonds after India. And so, you know, definitely having exports flowing again to China, as you can see in 2020, is very meaningful for the U.S. Ag sector, and for particular crops, it's even stronger. The other element that we saw in 2020 in the pandemic was the extensive federal support of agriculture. Pretty much, I guess, stimulus across the economy, though, so that wasn't necessarily an outlier. And I will say that some of the most, you know, the strongest impacts that affected in 2020 really occurred in products that were more around either transportation-related, like biofuels, or, say, in cotton around apparel. But when it came to tree nuts and apples, these are products which are actually were already majority consumed at home or on the go as a snack. And they were a little less prominent in the food service sector, and that meant that domestic demand was relatively more resilient for some of these permanent crops. We'll touch on what's happening in those markets, though, because there are individual you know, ups and downs affecting both the supply and demand side. But overall, for U.S. agriculture, for 2021 will be a year of likely higher production values across almost every segment, and it's one which is demand-led. Overall is what's really driving that, whether that's China or the U.S. I also want to put in context the crop types that are the core of this portfolio with almonds, pistachios, and apples. For U.S. agriculture overall, about 20% of production is exported. But in the case of pistachios and almonds, that's more than 65%. And that's because the U.S. produces 55% of the world's pistachios and 80% of the world's almonds. And so in those crop types, the U.S. is the dominant player as far as volume and also on quality. The next slide covers row crops, which I'm going to the next slide is the economic backdrop. And I think what we want to just point out here is that when it comes to U.S. agriculture for the crop types, in the portfolio and in general, really what we're looking at is what's happening in the largest destination markets for those products. In this case, that would be the U.S., that would be China, India, and also our North American neighbors with Mexico and Canada. And so overall, as we've seen a reopening of the economy, we have seen the ability for trade to flow more smoothly, which has been important for exports. And we've seen incomes also recovering in other parts of the world. I would say that at the moment, one thing we're keeping an eye on for those crop types where India is meaningful is certainly their COVID resurgence, but definitely in the U.S., strong recovery has been prominent. And we're hoping to see, again, that resurgence of that restaurant and food service demand coming back. Now, one element that we are tracking, again, has been on the inflation side and how that might affect these investments given the higher inflation. You know, generally what we have seen for farmland assets, whether in the permanent or row crop sectors, is that in periods of moderate inflation, we tend to see a corresponding increase in some of the cost of production and in turn in some of the prices for those agricultural commodities. It's not necessarily a one-to-one ratio, but we do believe that if we do see kind of sustained rather than transitory inflation, that we will see that translate into commodity prices impacting the farm. I do want to note, though, that the record low interest rates have been very supportive of asset values for permanent crops and row crops because that current cash flow that Stuart mentioned, its attractiveness relative to, say, the 10-year Treasury, that premium, if anything, you know, has widened over the last year with record low rates. So that's also very important when it comes to the valuation of farmland. I do want to skip the next slide, which is on row crops, so we'll move forward two slides, please. And just want to put where we sit today on almonds and pistachio prices in context. That is, we're certainly well off the highs of the last decade, but again, the prices that you see on the chart are reflecting the go-forward IRRs we have for the portfolio. There's certainly, in our opinion, you know, remains plenty of upside potential for pricing, but we're trying to be guarded about the fact that the high margins in the sector have attracted new capital. At the same time, before going into either market, I want to point out that some of the challenges when it comes to water supplies that are affecting portions of the Central Valley of California and that Carl will touch on are affecting future supply. And so to the extent there's any curtailment in the growth of almond and pistachio production overall, and because California is so prominent in the global picture, that could lead to higher prices. So we're going to keep an eye on that as well. But specific to the crop that was harvested in the last year, we did see almond prices soften, and much of that was due to record production. So we really had over 3.1 billion pounds of almonds, and that was up from the prior high of 2.6 billion pounds. That was due primarily to favorable weather. And so overall across the board, we saw higher yields than expected in certain properties, but also slightly lower prices. The good news is that over the first half of the almond marketing year, we've seen exports meet the pace of the larger crop. So that slight pullback in price has behaved as we would hope it would, and that is that the volumes have continued to flow. And so that's been a healthy indicator that at the lower price, we're continuing to see record export volumes despite some of the COVID interruptions. Similar story on pistachios, although I will say prices have held up better than expected. Part of that is because pistachios with an alternate bearing cycle on and off here, there was expectations of this year reaching that billion crop mark. Overall, for both of those tree nuts, we expect continued demand growth both here in the U.S. And internationally. And, you know, each tree nut, really what is occurring is very low per capita consumption rates in other parts of the world are growing. So in the U.S., we consume about 1 kilogram of tree nuts a year per person, which is more than 10 times the total level in China or India. So not just China, any other parts of the world. And that's what we're continuing to keep an eye on. In the interest of time, I think what I might do is flip to the next slide, and I just want to make a couple of comments about the apple markets before I wrap up. Unlike pistachios and almonds, where the majority of U.S. production is exported, apples are primarily a domestic crop. So about 20% of our U.S. apple production is exported. The remaining 80% is consumed domestically. And over the last year, We've seen apple prices tick up for the U.S. and export destinations, primarily due to a pullback in the volumes that we've seen, as well as apples really offering consumers a pretty good value as far as dollars per pound in the fresh fruit market. For each individual apple variety, the trajectory has been slightly different, but we've taken that into account. And so we look at each variety a little bit individually because of that. We see surging, of course, continued demand growth for varieties like Honeycrisp. And some of the older varieties like Red Delicious today are a little bit lower price and are factoring more into the export markets where consumers are, you know, for them, that apple provides an affordable option, but isn't necessarily the taste preference for U.S. consumers. We'll get happy to visit a little more about any of those market questions as we come back later in the presentation. But at this time, I'd like to turn it back to you, Stuart, and the rest of the team.
Great. Thanks, Dan. As we can see, a very much optimistic picture for where U.S. and global ag is heading in the coming 12 months and beyond, and specifically for the TMPC portfolio. I want to quickly touch on the Leading Harvest platform I mentioned earlier. I just think it's important to bring it to your attention that it's something that we as industry leaders have been working on since 2017 in tandem with many other, in fact, most other major farmland investment managers. We want to move to the next slide, 137. Basically, it's a formalization of and standardization of measured expectations for the management of agricultural land across the board. And it's guided by 13 main principles on the next slide, 138, that you can see that, as I said earlier, you know, nothing that we've really had to change our approach, just simply kind of putting them in a formal presentation and a formal measurable and monitorable method to ensure that we're fulfilling all of the promises and really contributing to the value. We enroll each acre of the portfolio into the land, and there's audit costs and there's enrollment costs, as with any platform. So on page 140, you'll see a summary of what the costs will be to the portfolio. And I just want to make sure that the 90-10 split that H&RG and TMPC are taking to the costs is very de minimis, because in fact in 2020 the total cost to the portfolio was less than $2,400. So the outcome certainly outweighs the cost in terms of standardizing and monitoring these aspects of farmland management. One of the 13 principles of Leading Harvest, in fact the third one, is the protection of water resources, which is a really important part of the TMPC portfolio. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Carl on the next slide, 141, to walk us through some of the issues and aspects in water management that we've been looking at.
Thanks, Stuart. Nice to be back with everybody again. We can go ahead and jump to the next slide, please. Let's highlight why California water is now a part of these meetings. You know, that's the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, that was passed in 2014. I'll just quickly give an overview of it, although I'm sure most of you by now are pretty familiar with it, so I'll keep it brief. The objective of SGMA was to reach the sustainable management of groundwater in the state of California by the year 2040. And sort of outlining a 20-year glide path to get there, which started last year in 2020. Two acronyms we'll talk about quite a bit are GSA and GSP. So Groundwater Sustainability Agencies, or GSAs, are the local public agencies that were formed to develop and manage groundwater sustainability plans, or GSPs, and those plans really outline sort of where a basin is now and how it will reach sustainability for its local circumstances in 2040. Really, I think the important part of SGMA here in talking about these two acronyms is that local management of meeting sustainability is sort of the key to success. And so, you know, each one of these sub-basins has specific levels of sustainable pumping, and those are now determined from really complex and expensive hydrologic models as well as just, you know, geopolitical conditions. And so each GSA within sub-basin sort of takes those local circumstances and local characteristics and is allowed to manage its pathway to sustainability, you know, with the state as a backstop to ensure that we don't have bad actors. And we'll see that, you know, those factors range widely across the San Joaquin Valley. There are some GSAs in the state that are already in balance and have near no action other than monitoring, and then you'll have the opposite end of the spectrum where certain GSAs have quite a ways to go to meet 2040. So, you know, exactly how to reach sustainability was really left to those GSAs to decide in the legislation sigma. And so, you know, there'll be a wide sort of array of tools employed, and I think there are really two categories of those. There's sort of supply enhancement, and then there's demand management. You know, and we will see now that we're in the early phases that much of the focus in all of these agencies is going to be on that sort of supply development or enhancement, with demand management being sort of the next phase of implementation after the more opportunistic resources or management practices have been exhausted. So each of the GSAs in critically overdrafted basins or high-priority basins, which would make up most of the San Joaquin Valley in California, had to submit their plans, their GSPs, to the State Department of Water Resources in January 2020. So we're now into the real-life phase of implementation of this act, and then we'll be expecting medium priority basins to start developing plans soon, as they need to submit those to the state by January 30th of 2022. And then if we jump to the next slide, we can talk a little bit about how H&RG sort of has managed water and continues to. That's on slide 143. You know, there's really a long history of successful water management at H&RG with a pretty deep bench of experience in sort of navigating the ever-changing, you know, climate and political situation. And this might be a good time to actually pause and talk about this current year's drought. And I think that gives good context for how H&RG is equipped to manage sigma implementation going forward. So I'm sure most everyone has seen quite a few headlines about the drought conditions facing California. I would say that I would expect those headline frequencies to increase as the year goes on because it is a significant drought. But this portfolio of properties for TMPC will actually not see any sort of shortfalls in its water supplies. It still has full access to the water that it needs for the drought. So you can rest easy when you see the headlines as it pertains to your portfolio. And I think, you know, the reason we can talk about that is because both strategic investment into the right places, you know, really good strategy when we went through the hold sell process a little while ago, and now we have properties that are weathered to, or set up to weather drought successfully. And so when you think about sigma, it's just yet another change to sort of climate and political situations in California, but a couple of highlights of what we've done to be prepared for that. I think, as you know, we retained New Current Water and Land in 2016, very highly experienced and well-regarded consulting firm that has a long track record of history in California water policy. And then we've invested into a really robust internal team to manage water resources for the portfolio. So that starts with sort of a globally aligned leadership and then, you know, country and regionally focused strategy, and then the appropriate level of staff to really focus on executing that strategy on the ground and making sure that each individual property is as well positioned as it can. for both current and future the state of California water. So with respect to Sigma, that, you know, that team regularly attends these GSA and district meetings and is really deeply engaged in the policy discussions that develop these GSPs, but then also concern the implementation of these GSPs over the next 20 years. So the team has a sort of a suite of water management tools for on-farm water management that it's employing. You know, some of that is groundwater recharge, where it is possible groundwater credit trading systems and the development of those at sort of the public agency level, surface water supply and development, and then just looking at alternative land uses to offset fallow costs. If we jump to slide 144, we can get...
Hey, Carl, I think we need to wrap up this part of it and move into closed session on the portfolio. We're kind of running up against time, so if you could wrap up in the next minute or so and then jump into our portfolio, that'd be good.
Sure, no problem. Okay, so the really short of it then is that this portfolio on... is really well positioned to weather Sigma. And we've got two properties that we're still watching closely, Tulare 20 and 24. They're a little bit higher risk of a GSA. I think there's still opportunities to have, you know, pretty acceptable returns in farming situations on a go forward. But then the rest of the properties really do not have any fallowing or reduction of farmed acres even in the plans because they are in balance. And so I think, you know, we're well positioned to navigate Sigma. So unless there's questions or anything, we can go to the next part.
Yeah, let's go to the next part in closed session. We will come back in open session only to adjourn and go to the supplemental meeting where there's no other topics that haven't been covered. So I don't know that it's worth a lot of people's time to hang on there, but let us go to closed session now.